This week's show is sponsored by Audible, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser and the Rude Pundit, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. The Rude Pundit has the week off. Our top story this week is an update on ISIS, including the murder by ISIS of journalist James Foley and how the president is responding. We'll play an excerpt from the president's speech on the subject. Then we talk about racism in America in the near wake of the Ferguson protests. After that, we have a look at the indictment of Texas Governor Rick Perry and the hack gap between liberal and conservative journalism. Finally, I drill down on how the race to control the Senate in 2014 is shaping up. If you want to write to me and give me your opinion of anything we cover, write to me at makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just air your comments on the air next week. Once again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. Our top story on ISIS and their murder of James Foley starts now. Ladies and gentlemen, word came earlier this week that journalist James Foley, who was a freelance videographer and reporter for Global Post and Agent France Press, was executed by ISIS, or ISIL, whatever you feel like calling them, the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And he was executed in perhaps one of the most brutal exhibitions I have ever seen. I saw some of the photos and video, and I can only imagine how horrific it was for Mr. Foley's loved ones to have seen that. Mr. Foley was kidnapped about 21 months ago. He went missing from a town about 25 miles south of the Turkish border. He was supposed to meet with a friend, a fellow photojournalist, and he apparently stopped at an internet cafe to send some images that he had taken to the folks that he was working for, and soon after, some armed men sped up behind his car and forced him out at gunpoint. Before killing Mr. Foley, ISIS had demanded a ransom from the United States. Before I talk more about that, the President Barack Obama spoke on Wednesday the 20th to give his thoughts regarding the murder of James Foley.
Today, the entire world is appalled by the brutal murder of Jim Foley by the terrorist group ISIL. Jim was taken from us in an act of violence that shocks the conscience of the entire world. Let's be clear about ISIL. They have rampaged across cities and villages, killing innocent, unarmed civilians in cowardly acts of violence. They abduct women and children, and subject them to torture and rape and slavery. They have murdered Muslims, both Sunni and Shia, by the thousands. They target Christians and religious minorities, driving them from their homes, murdering them when they can, for no other reason than they practice a different religion. They declare their ambition to commit genocide against an ancient people. So ISIL speaks for no religion. Their victims are overwhelmingly Muslim, and no faith teaches people to massacre innocents. And people like this ultimately fail. They fail because the future is won by those who build and not destroy, and the world is shaped by people like Jim Foley and the overwhelming majority of humanity who are appalled by those who killed him. The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. From governments and peoples across the Middle East, there has to be a common effort to extract this cancer so that it does not spread.
Now, many of you who listen to this show regularly were probably surprised last week at the common thread between what I and the Root Pundit were saying regarding ISIS / ISIL. Because if you listen to this show, you know that he and I are generally anti-war. Well, he hasn't been on the show very much, but if you've read his blog, you know he is generally anti-war. I'm generally anti-war. But ISIS represents, as President Obama put it, a cancer on the Middle East and the world that has to be dealt with. They're so radical that they were kicked out of Al-Qaeda for being too extreme. Just think about that, folks. I want to repeat that. These folks, ISIS, ISIL, are so radical, they were kicked out of Al-Qaeda for being too extreme. And you saw that with this execution of poor Mr. Foley. Having his, and you might want to turn down the volume if you don't want to hear this brief detail that I want to give. His neck was cut off with a regular knife. It wasn't like it was chopped with an axe or a big sword, a regular knife. So he probably suffered quite a bit through that whole thing. Now, reports came out in the New York Times and other places after the execution that for the longest time, ISIS had been demanding a large, what's the word that you use in kidnappings? A large ransom for the return of Mr. Foley. And details came out of exactly how high that ransom was. That ransom that they were asking for was $132 million. And one of the things that angered me when details of that came out is that apparently, the United States, well, I don't know about the United States, it didn't specify the United States, but European countries have funneled millions of dollars to ISIS and Al-Qaeda over the last several years to secure the release of various captives. So, of course, that's only going to encourage these folks to do it again and again. And James Foley might be dead because some of those countries paid in the past. I'm not blaming those countries, though. It's the fault of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. But still, you cannot pay folks like this. I don't understand why it has been done. Of course, you want your citizens back. You want your loved ones back. You can't pay. You cannot pay. And this shows why. But Mr. Foley was not the only American that is being held by ISIS. There are several others, and ISIS has threatened that if the President of the United States doesn't halt the bombing campaign, that the rest of them, or at least one or two more, will be killed. Now, unfortunately for those people, and my heart goes out to them, I can only imagine if it was a loved one of mine, what I think the President has to do in response is not only not stop the bombing campaign, the president has to step up the bombing campaign. As a matter of fact, I did some research, folks. ISIS wanted $132 million for the return of James Foley. I think we should drop $132 million worth of bombs on ISIS. I think that that would be a fitting reaction from the United States to ISIS's actions. I did some further research, and $132 million would buy about 5,000 2,000-pound bombs with what's called JDAM munitions, or joint direct attack munitions, which makes dumb regular 2,000-pound bombs into smart bombs. So $132 million buys about 5,000 of those. And I think we should drop 5,000 JDAMs on ISIS. That should be the reaction of the United States to the murder of James Foley. You know, one of the things that ISIS did when they formed into something resembling a regular army, when they tried to take form into an army and take territory, is that they've made themselves into something that the large armed forces of the world, those of like the United States, Russia, China, Great Britain, and other countries that have large armed forces, ISIS made themselves into something that those armed forces are very well equipped to deal with. Large armies and armed forces do not deal with guerrillas and other groups engaging in asymmetric warfare. But if you form yourself into a regular army and buy armored personnel carriers and steel tanks and try to take and hold territory, our military is very good at dealing with that. I don't think we should send ground forces beyond perhaps some special forces designed to locate targets and things like that. But I think we should use our very skilled and efficient air force to target concentrations of ISIS fighters wherever they appear. And we should bomb and pound them until they cease to be anything at all resembling a regular fighting unit. And when they degenerate into, at least this is what I think would happen, if we eliminate ISIS's ability to act as an army and hold territory, they'll degenerate into a guerrilla unit or asymmetric warfare unit, and then I think we should send drones after them. That's what these guys deserve. It's not just what they deserve. Considering the kind of brutality and just complete lack of humanity that these folks demonstrate, I don't think there's really another option that we have of dealing with these people. If, by the way, they'll take Iraq and Syria if we let them. And as the Root Pundit and I, you know, talked about and mused last week, they would not stop there. They are already talking about establishing a caliphate. A caliphate or caliphate, I don't know how you would pronounce it. It's really an Arabic word. Refers to an Islamic state led by a supreme religious and political leader known as a caliph. Now, the caliphates in history were encompassed large swaths of territory from North Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, and into Asia Minor. And this vision of a greater Islamic state still looms large over significant portions of the Muslim community. And it is this idea that ISIS is taking advantage of in order to gain recruits. Now, what this means is they've basically as much as made clear that they would not be satisfied with Syria and Iraq. I think they would attempt to take most of the rest of the Middle East, if not all of it. I think Iran would probably be one of their next targets. Iran's people are mostly practitioners of the Shia form of Islam. ISIS are Sunnis, and so they would try to take Iran. They would probably take Jordan and Lebanon, and they would threaten Israel, and they would ultimately probably reunite with Al-Qaeda if they were that successful. I'm guessing that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban would want to reunite with them. And before you know it, if the United States doesn't act, there would be this massive radical Islamic state in the Middle East and Asia. And as I've said, and we've all seen, these folks are absolutely brutal. So, you know, unfortunately for the folks that they still hold, I think we have to consider those folks as lost. I hate to say it, and I you know, I apologize if my saying that distresses their loved ones, but we can't pay these people millions of dollars. What do you think they're going to do with that millions of dollars? They're going to buy weapons. They're going to buy weapons and use it in this vision that they have for a greater pan-Islamic state. And what's more, if we pay them, we're just going to encourage them to kidnap more people. So we cannot pay them. And I hope the president decides that, and it sounds from what he gave, the speech that he gave on Wednesday, and from the actions that he's taken since then, that he recognizes the threat that ISIS poses and is going to deal with them appropriately. There were 6 new airstrikes on Thursday the 21st, the day after the president gave his speech. So I think we're going to see... Now, the one complication about this is that ISIS, in fact, is operating out of both Iraq and Syria. And there was an article in the New York Times that mentioned how the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said that ISIS cannot be defeated unless the United States or its allies take on the Sunni militancy in Syria. This is an organization that has an apocalyptic end-of-days strategic vision that will eventually have to be defeated, according to Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey. Can they be defeated without addressing that part of the organization that resides in Syria? The answer is no. And that probably makes sense. If they know we're only going to bomb them in Iraq, they're going to move to Syria. As a matter of fact, they may have moved significant members of their forces already. Now, that poses a bit of a quandary, right? Particularly for me, because, once again, if you're a longtime listener to the show, you know that I disagreed with President Obama's initially stated intent to get involved in the Syrian conflict. I'm still very much against him getting involved in the civil war in any way. But what I would agree with are airstrikes against ISIS bases and personnel in Syria. That very specific involvement, I guess you could say, even though I don't consider it involvement in the civil war, but that very specific action in Syria is something that I would support. And I think that, I don't know what obstacles there would be in terms of politics or diplomacy. I don't know. Does the president have any diplomacy with Syria left? Do we have any, United States? I don't know how much we have. I don't know how much it matters. But we do have to address that part of ISIS that is in Syria. We've got to do as much as possible to wipe these folks out. I totally agree with the president's characterization. They are a cancer that needs to be removed. We'll be right back. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible. Listeners of Making Sense with Steve Laser can get a free audiobook and 30-day trial membership if they sign up at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles and virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. For instance, Inferno, the latest novel by Dan Brown, is available, as is The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith. Sign up now at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense. Welcome back to Making Sense with Steve Laser, ladies and gentlemen. Well, this Friday, as the protests began to subside, the National Guard troops began leaving Ferguson, Missouri, and various members of the community were talked to by the media. In People magazine, they talked to Pekolua Thurman, who had marched on Thursday night. And one of the things that Ms. Thurman noted was that even though the issues were regarding the individual who was shot in Ferguson, just about everybody in the black community in the United States knows somebody who was either severely mistreated or shot by the police. What I want to talk to everybody about today isn't so much the Ferguson issue itself, but race relations in the United States of America. And one of the things that I want to start with is a really good interview that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg gave on Wednesday. She gave an interview to the National Law Journal on Wednesday, and she was talking about how events in Ferguson, Missouri, and racially based things, policies like stop and frisk, really showed how race relations have not progressed in this country very much in the last 20, 30, 40 years. And unfortunately, Justice Ginsburg noticed that Supreme Court efforts to help with issues of systemic racial bias in the United States have changed. She remarked that in the 1970s, in the early 1970s in particular, you had the 1971 decision of Griggs versus Duke Power Company, in which the Supreme Court unanimously held that employer policies that look neutral on paper can still constitute discrimination if they disproportionately harm minorities in practice. And Justice Ginsburg said that it was a very influential decision. It was picked up in England, and that's where the court was headed in the 1970s. And she contrasts this with where the court is headed today. And one of the decisions that she talks about is the 2013 decision in Shelby County v. Holder, which struck down a key provision that helped minorities, particularly African Americans, against racial discrimination in voting laws. It struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. And just to go into it a little bit more, that decision struck down the part of the Voting Rights Act which requires certain states and local governments to obtain what's called federal preclearance before implementing any changes to their voting laws or practices, which contains the coverage formula that determines which jurisdictions are subjected to preclearance based on their histories of discrimination in voting. And I want to read a little bit about what the majority decision was in that case. The majority opinion was delivered by Chief Justice John Roberts, and it was joined by Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito. And it said that this part of the Voting Rights Act that I talked about earlier exceeded Congress's power to enforce the 14th and 15th Amendments, reasoning that the coverage formula conflicts with the constitutional principles of federalism and equal sovereignty of the states, because the disparate treatment of the states is based on 40-year-old facts having no logical relationship to the present day, and is thus not responsive to current needs. Now, Justice Ginsburg specifically called out that wording and said that when you look at things like what happened in Ferguson, when you look at the stop and frisk law that was enacted in New York City, and when you look at the real issues of Republicans in various southern states trying to enact voter suppression laws, voter ID laws, she notes that it's just not true what Chief Justice Roberts said in his majority decision, that things have changed dramatically and thus we don't need the Voting Rights Act. In her dissent to that decision in Shelby County v. Holder, she said that throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. And I think that just says it really well. One other decision that I want to talk about is the decision this year in 2014 that the Supreme Court upheld, which was regarding Michigan's ban on affirmative action. And that case was Schuette versus Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. And very quickly, the facts in that case were a 2006 referendum passed by 58% of voters in the state of Michigan that banned the use of racial criteria in college admissions and was overturned by a lower court. Now, the majority members of the Supreme Court said that the reason why they upheld this law banning affirmative action is because the lower court didn't have the authority to resolve that case. But what Justice Sonia Sotomayor said was she issued her dissent in a very unusual way. She took the unusual step of reading part of her dissent from the bench, taking more than 15 minutes to express her concern about the ruling's impact, according to this article in CNN. She said, "This refusal to accept the stark reality that race matters is regrettable. The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to speak openly and candidly on the subject of race and to apply the Constitution with eyes open to the unfortunate effects of centuries of racial discrimination. As members of the judiciary tasked with intervening to carry out the guarantee of equal protection, we ought not to sit back and wish it away rather than confront the racial inequality that exists in our society." So, obviously, Justice Sonia Sotomayor agrees with Ruth Bader Ginsburg that we do not exist in a post-racial society. And, you know, wherever you fall on the Ferguson situation, the one thing that I don't think that you can argue is that we're in a post-racial society. And this is something that Republicans have consistently been trying to argue, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years since President Obama was elected. Oh, we've got an African-American president elected. That must mean there's no issues of race in this country anymore. Very wishful thinking, obviously, and it's wishful thinking that allows them to pursue this agenda, certainly in terms of voting rights and trying to restrict the ability of African-Americans to vote, but also all kinds of other things across the political spectrum. And there really are, you know, everywhere you turn, there are issues of race in this country. Going back to Ferguson, forgetting for a moment the young man who was shot, you have this city of 20,000 people that is predominantly African American, that is represented by almost an exclusively white city council. And you have a police force that is disproportionately white, serving an area of predominantly African-American citizens. Now, you can blame some of the city council membership on voter apathy. Of course, we don't know that for sure yet, but you could say that if African-Americans wanted African-American representation, they can go out and vote for it, and if they're not doing that, that's partly their own fault. But when you typically see issues like this, there's usually other things involved. We don't know that for sure here in the case of Ferguson, but clearly you have a situation where folks aren't being represented by people who understand them and understand their problems. So, getting back to this overarching idea that I'm talking about here today, do we have a post-racial country? And the answer is no, we do not have a post-racial country. We have a lot of challenges in the area of race. Do we not need things like the Voting Rights Act? Of course we do. Of course we still need that. Do we have issues with the police and how they handle issues with African Americans? We absolutely do. I think I've mentioned on previous shows that I live in Harlem, and I have actually seen young African American men stopped and frisked who were doing absolutely nothing wrong. And I want to tell you folks, it's one thing to contemplate the idea of stop and frisk as sort of a philosophical issue. But when you see in the United States, a country where we're supposed to be free and if we're not doing anything wrong, we're supposed to be able to live out our lives without fear of harassment by government officials, when you actually see somebody walking down the street and stopped by the police and told they have no choice but to submit to being searched. And the searches are really thorough. I mean, they look in all their pockets, they pat them down from top to bottom. When you actually see something like that, then you realize how big of a problem it is and how big of a conflict it is with the values that we supposedly have as Americans, as in they are enshrined in our Constitution. So this entire thing is, it's Michael Brown's death at the hands of a police officer when he was unarmed, that's the immediate issue that we're all concerned about here. But there's a lot bigger deal in terms of race surrounding it. And it really is going to take a sustained and considered effort from all the folks who care about it to really start addressing it. Because we have, unfortunately, this resistance from the conservative right in this country to even acknowledge that a lot of these problems exist. And that's really a shame. And we need more justices like Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. As Ginsburg noted, the court in the 1970s seemed much more willing to try to address this issue of racial problems in this country. And their decisions worked. And the decisions of courts before that worked. So, you know, we are not in a post-racial country, and we need to stop acting as if we are. We'll be right back. We don't get fooled again. Don't get fooled again. No, no.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational. Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light. Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light. Welcome back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as many of you know, that Governor Rick Perry of Texas has been indicted on two felonies for abuse of power and coercion of a public servant. What happened was that, if you haven't already heard, Rick Perry threatened and ultimately did veto $7.5 million in funding to the Travis County Public Integrity Group, and he did that because, so he says, that District Attorney Rosemary Lemberg refused to resign from her position at the TCPI following a DUI conviction. Now, I have to mention at least one thing that is sort of important, and that is that I met Rick Perry in the green room of Fox News, had a very cordial chat with him. Seems like a very nice guy. And I have to admit that when I first heard of these charges being levied against him, I really wasn't on board with them. They seemed to me like a political witch hunt. I have to be perfectly honest. And I'm not the only one. My friend Amanda Marcotte, who writes for Pendagon, noted that Simon Malloy has a good piece up at Salon about the Rick Perry indictment and talked about how a fairly good amount of prominent liberals are speaking out against it, including New York Magazine's Jonathan Chait, MSNB host Ari Melber, American Prospect contributor Scott Lemieux, the Center for American Progress's Ian Millhiser, and The New Republic's Alec McGillis. In addition, the New York Times
put out an editorial talking about whether Governor Rick Perry's bad judgment is really a crime, and they seem to not be entirely sure that it was. And, you know, I saw Amanda Marcotte's article where she talked about the things that I talked about. That came out on the 18th. And I almost wrote a piece, her article came out Tuesday, August 19th. I almost wrote a piece agreeing with her. Because if a Democratic governor had been indicted on the same charges, I would have really thought that politics were behind it, that Republicans were behind it. And, you know, it is possible that politics are playing a role in what is going on here. However, the group Forward Progressives at forwardprogressives.com came out with a new take on this that I think people should read. And one of the things that they talk about is that during Rick Perry's tenure, there have been two other district attorneys who were convicted of DUIs, but Governor Perry didn't push for them to resign. In 2002, Swisher County District Attorney Terry McAkern was arrested in New Mexico after a family called police reporting someone swerving into oncoming traffic and driving off the shoulder of the road. Then in 2009, Kaufman County District Attorney Rick Harrison was arrested after driving the wrong way down a street and hitting another car. And Forward Progressives notes that that was actually Harrison's second DWI conviction. Now, here's the interesting thing. Both of those men were Republicans, and the person who he tried to force to resign was a Democrat. Now, here's another interesting piece of information. It seems that Ms. Lemberg, the person who he was trying to force to resign, was investigating Governor Perry's office for possible corruption charges during the time of her DUI. So now we have a very problematic combination of events. We have two Republican district attorneys who Mr. Perry did not try to force to resign, but we have a Democratic district attorney who was investigating his office, who he tried to force to resign with a threat of a veto for funding for the office to which she belonged. So now we have a very different situation. And I agree with Forward Progressives that that additional revelation may send Rick Perry straight to prison, and he would definitely deserve it if all of those things turn out to be true. And I feel bad because, like I said, folks, I met him. He's really a fairly nice guy. You know, I when I met him, I said, listen, I'm a Democrat and I disagree with you on just about everything. And he was still very nice. And, you know, I hate to see bad things happen to anybody. But if he tried to use the powers of his office to squelch an investigation that way, then he deserves to be prosecuted. One other note that I would make about this event. You remember all of those names of progressive and liberal columnists, in addition to the editorial board of the New York Times, who spoke out initially against this indictment of Governor Rick Perry. And one of the things that Amanda Marcotte points out, and I absolutely agree with her in her article, can you imagine Republicans like Breitbart, Red State, and those folks, can you imagine them speaking out against the indictment of a Democratic governor in a similar situation? You know, I totally agree with Amanda Marcotte when she says that she does not think that that would happen. I cannot imagine that happening. I can't imagine it because I think back in all of the scandals and things like that that have befallen various Democrats over the last 20 years or so, I can't think of a single one where prominent Republicans came out to defend them. Marcotte calls this the hack gap. And what she means by this is that basically everybody who's in the media, all conservatives and Republicans that are in the media, are straight out hacks. They will not do the right thing if it benefits a Democrat. Whereas that is not true for those of us on the progressive and Democratic side of the House. We were already, well, not all, a number of us had and were preparing to defend Rick Perry based on the initial information that was presented. Again, I cannot imagine members of the conservative media doing the same thing. And that's a shame, folks. And that is another example of the difference between liberals and Democrats and conservatives and Republicans. We'll be right back. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R.
Zero Zulix uploaded.
Welcome back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've been taking a look for the past several weeks and months at how the 2014 midterm congressional elections are shaping up. For the longest time, we've been hearing how the 2014 elections would be a big victory for the Republicans. They were going to use health care reform. They were going to use Benghazi. Those two issues have obviously fallen by the wayside. Far too many Americans are benefiting from the Affordable Care Act. Benghazi has been completely debunked, not the least of which by the one of the head perpetrators of the attacks, and also by at least one or two Republican-controlled committees that have found no wrongdoing in Benghazi. So as we look now at election 2014, it's clear that Republicans are probably going to pick up a couple of seats both in the Senate and the House, but it is not going to be any type of wave election like we saw in 2010. I also do not believe that Republicans will pick up control of the Senate. And one of the pieces of analysis that really struck me as particularly good, it's no surprise because I tend to like the analysis done from this site, but it's the one from 538.com, which is Nate Silver's site, and an article by Harry Enten takes us through how he sees the race for control of the Senate. The article's titled, 6 Consistently Close Races That Will Probably Decide Control of the Senate. So Mr. Enten believes, and I agree with him, that aside from these 6 races, we can pretty much already figure out how most of the other races are going to play out. And without going into all the rest of those, I want to concentrate on the 6. But without those 6, the way the Senate would stand is 48 for the Republicans and 46 for Democrats. So that already has Republicans picking up 3 seats from where things are now. Right now, the way things are 53 Democrats in the Senate, 45 Republicans in the Senate, with 2 independents both of whom caucus with the Democrats. The six seats that remain are in Alaska, Arkansas, Colorado, Iowa, Louisiana, and North Carolina. Now, in Alaska, Mr. Enten says that polls are showing Democratic incumbent Senator Mark Begich with approximately a 3-point lead against the Republican nominee Sullivan. Mr. Enten is quick to point out that there is a sort of ugly history of inaccurate polling in Alaska, so it is possible that the 3-point lead isn't worth much. But as it stands now, that is what Mr. Begich has. And again, this is not one single poll. What Nate Silver and 538 does, they take an aggregate of the most, what they determine to be the most accurate polls. So they take a number of them, they average them out, and then they add what they believe are a number of different intangibles, how the state or district has voted in the past and various other things that they think could influence the race. And they've been very successful with their predictions using this model. So according to that model, they have Begich up by about 3 points. So we'll add that one to the Democratic column, and that makes it then, and now, by the way, 538 does not add that to the Democratic poll column. They show them as too close to call, even though these races that I'm going to talk about are between 1 and 3 percentage points either way. So let's, for our purposes, let's put that in the Democratic column. That makes it 47 Democrats to 48 Republicans in the Senate. Then we go to Arkansas, where we have incumbent Democratic Senator Mark Pryor hoping to hold on to his seat against the Republican nominee, Representative Tom Cotton. And 538 has Pryor, the Democrat, down by 1.9 points. So we'll mark that one. We'll mark Arkansas in the Republican column. That makes it 47 Democrats to 49 Republicans. Now, I should point out at this point, we're at 47 to 49. Republicans need 51 seats to take control of the Senate. If they just get 50 and have it as 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans, then Vice President Biden would cast the deciding vote in control of the Senate, to determine control of the Senate, I should say, and that would give Democrats the smallest of margins in control of Democrats, but they would control all the committees and all those sorts of things, so that kind of thing matters. So Republicans need 51 seats to take control. So right now we're at 47-49. So let's look at Colorado. Colorado has incumbent Democratic Senator Mark Udall against Republican Representative Cory Gardner. 538 shows Udall ahead by 1 point. So we'll mark that in the Democratic column. And now we have 48 Democratic seats to 49 Republican seats. Next, we have Iowa, and this is a completely open seat. There is no incumbent. We have Democratic Representative Bruce Bailey against Republican State Senator Joni Ernst. Right now, the Democrat, Bruce Bailey, is up by 1 percentage point in the current aggregate, according to 538.com. So we'll put that in the Democratic column for now. That's 49 Democrats to 49 Republicans, with two more seats remaining. Now, Republicans, in order to get 51, according to how we're placing things, would need to take both of those remaining seats in order to take control. In Louisiana, we have an incumbent Democrat, Senator Mary Landrieu, and things are a bit unusual in Louisiana. You have multiple candidates in a general election, and then if nobody gets 50% of the vote in November, there is a runoff in December. That is the way things usually happen, because you have multiple candidates and nobody's able to get 50%, and that is what people are predicting again. So right now, she is polling at about 0.5 of a point behind the top Republican, and for the as far as what the way things are expected to work out in the runoff. Now, I would not count Senator Landrieu out. She seems to understand how to win in a what is usually a reliably red state. She has been down just about every single time that she has run for election in Louisiana, and she finds out a way. She finds a way to pull it out in the end. But we're going to put that one in the Republican column for now. I'm being consistent. Whatever 538 has, no matter how small it is, we're counting that as a win. So that would be 50 seats for Republicans, 49 seats for Democrats. Then let's go to the last state, North Carolina. And in that state, we've had an up-and-down race between incumbent Democratic Senator Kay Hagan and the Republican State House Speaker Tom Tillis. Now, right now, they have the Democrat, incumbent Senator Kay Hagan, up by 1.5 points. So if we put North Carolina in the Democratic column, we have 50 Democratic seats, we have 50 Republican seats, and we have Vice President Joe Biden casting the deciding vote to give control to the Democrats. So right now, I am predicting that the Democrats will retain control of the Senate in election 2014. Now, if I look at this race in Louisiana, I would have to guess that Senator Landrieu is going to pull that out. I believe that she is going to pull it out. And I think when all things are said and done after the runoff in December, what you're actually going to have is 51 Democrats and 49 Republicans. That is my final prediction on how election 2014 will shake out. That still gives Republicans a pickup of 4 seats in the Senate. It gives them a couple of seats in the House. I'll give my final prediction of the U.S. House in the next week or two. I shouldn't say final. I mean, you know, we have about, depending upon when you hear this, if you hear this on Monday, the 71 days till Election Day, if you hear this today, Sunday, the 24th, you have 72 days until Election Day. Things can happen in those final 72 days that can change things dramatically. But absent that, I think this is the way things are trending now and the way things are going to shake out. And that's actually very good news for Democrats. You never want to lose seats, but the control of the Senate is the big news in 2014. If Republicans don't get it, that'll be a big blow for them. If Democrats lose it, that will be a big blow for them. And looking forward to 2016, I happen to think at this point, even though she hasn't declared that she's going to run, that Hillary is going to win in 2016, and she's going to win big, and she is going to pull a lot of seats in her coattails for the Democrats. So I think in 2016, Democrats will pick up seats in the Senate, and they will pick up seats in the House. So this is really Republicans' last best chance for a while to pick up seats in Congress, the way I think things are going to shake out. So I see good news for Democrats on the horizon in 2014 and 2016, but unfortunately, that's all the time I have for today's show. Thank you very much for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, August 31st, and Monday, September 1st at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. The Rude Pundit Lee Papa will be back next week in all of his rude curmudgeonly glory. Is that a word? Curmudgeonly? I don't know. Works for me. Be sure to follow The Rude Pundit at rudepundit.blogspot.com and me and the show on Twitter at Stephen Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week. Yeah.